In this episode, Ryan and I sit down after a long hiatus, and we talk about future projects, the sequence of returns risk, and the role of life insurance in managing it. This is a good one. You don't want to miss it. Thank you for listening, and Merry Christmas. What a way to celebrate Christmas.
I had a call with a gentleman in California who, he learned about IBC a month ago, and he'd mastered it. So, I mean, red flag number one. But then after talking to me for the first time, and then prior to our second conversation, which was our last, he expressed how he had learned about private placement life insurance, where you could throw a bunch of money at a variable universal life contract and then indirectly exercise control over how those funds were invested in order to reap discretionary investment gains in a non-taxable environment. And my first point to him was, oh, you mean the one that is under extreme federal scrutiny right now? Oh, that one, yeah. There's a 2024 U.S. Senate Debt and Taxation Management Subcommittee report on this. But anyway, he was really attracted by that, right? Because, ooh, high rates of return. So we're return chasing. And, you know, we're finding the special hack.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Special hack. I get the shortcut, right? Special shortcut hack, which always works out so well. And so I was explaining to him that, you know, universal life, they throw all these great rates of return at you. And there's always some assumed rate of growth there. And the problem is we have a very specific monetary system in this country called fractional reserve banking. And as a result, we have what's called the business cycle, which everybody will be familiar with, these periods of great booms followed by acute dramatic declines, corrections in the value of publicly traded assets. This is the 2008 correction. This is the 2001.com burst and other similar type periods. And
1997, 1973, 1967.
Yeah, they go on and on. You know, it's called the business cycle.
1893, 1910.
For a reason. You know, it is cyclical. It does continue to happen over and over again, and that's not a bug. It's a feature of the system, and you could get conspiratorial as to the intentionality behind that. But regardless, it is a cycle, and it does continue to occur. And so I got this idea in my head. It's like, and I had a little conversation with AI about it. Of where it ultimately ended up was, I wonder if anybody has, in an academic paper, articulated the relationship with or between the business cycle on the one hand and what's called sequence of returns risk in the financial planning industry on the other hand. And for those who don't know, sequence of returns risk, as articulated by Investopedia, is the danger that the timing of withdrawals from a retirement account, or really any account, will negatively impact the overall rate of return available to the investor. And in particular, account withdrawals during a bear market are more costly than the same withdrawals in a bull market. And the basic intuition is that if we're in a bear market, if the prices of publicly traded assets have decreased acutely, substantially, like they did, for instance, in 2008, well, then the value of the securities or the publicly traded assets in that portfolio are trading at that lower price. So if you're taking withdrawals, you're liquidating, you're selling those assets at those now lower prices. And the concern, the risk here, is that the result will be that you outlive your money, right? That the remaining account value as a result of your selling assets at depressed prices will be insufficient to provide for the cash flow that you would need in order to live out your life with dignity and the same sort of standard of living you've come to expect. That is sequence of returns risk. And so, you know, I already knew in Austrian business cycle theory, and I'm going to quote here specifically from a reformulation of Austrian business cycle theory in light of the financial crisis, an article in the Quarterly Journal of Austrian Economics in the spring of 2012 by Joseph Salerno, academic vice president of the Mises Institute. He writes, although overconsumption is caused directly by what may be called the wealth or net worth effect, it is financed by the increase in the money supply and, later in the boom, the drawing down of cash balances as inflationary expectations take hold. So the idea there is that, okay, we're in the boom period and asset prices
literally
are, and this is where I'm going, but asset prices are flying off the roof, right? And so we feel wealthy. Of course, we know that that's not wealth. Wealth is goods and services. We feel artificially overcapitalized. We feel like we have a lot of monetary value that we can get access to. And so we overconsume. And my little point here to Bob was that, you know, early retirement, stopping working sooner than you otherwise would, liquidating assets for passive cash flow in retirement earlier than you otherwise would, is a form of overconsumption. Mm-hmm. And it induces people, therefore the business cycle induces people into the sequence of returns risk trap, right? It sets you up to fail because you've had this inflationary effect. You feel more capitalized than you otherwise would have been. You overconsume in different ways, one of which is potentially early quote unquote retirement because you can afford it, quote unquote, so to speak. And so you start drawing down assets and then bang, the cyclical, relatively more or less predictable correction occurs. And now suddenly you're in a position where you may have to go back to work, right? Risk outliving your money, as the saying has gone. And so my little question to Grok AI was, gosh, I wonder if anybody's articulated that connection before, that the business cycle as articulated by Austrian economists explains how people could be induced into a sequence risk trap. And Grok's little response was, no one's made that point before. So anyway, I was explaining, a lot of background, I know, sorry.
No, but it was good.
So I was explaining this to you, talking about, you know, because the PhD is going to be finished, and it's like, what's next, and what am I going to write about next? And so this is like one little idea. And if somebody beats me to it, I don't really care, but nobody will. and so we got to talk about that. And then so you mentioned, well, yeah, not only does the business cycle affect the psychology and the financial decision-making of people nearing retirement, it affects everybody's decision-making, which of course it does. Yeah, let me shut up and you can.
No, I remember the conversation. I was up in Iowa and it was like 32 degrees, not even 32, 27 degrees and windy. Very cold. and also the sequence of returns risk in combining the Austrian business cycle theory. You know, we spoke of the origins of that, and the possibility of the origins of that was in the 4% rule, the same individual in the 70s, I believe.
William Bengen, B-E-N-G-E-N, 1994, wrote this article that became the basis of what was known as the 4% rule, the rate that at that time you could draw down an account value without outliving your money.
Yeah, and it maybe is additional information, but that 4%, that percentage has changed,
funny,
modified some over time. But so specifically to that conversation, and I'm going purely off memory here, it's like, yes, the sequence of returns risk, no, there's no question that it affects you in retirement, right? And it is overspending. There's no question that it gives us this euphoric feeling when we're in the peak or the heading toward the peak of a business cycle theory, which is where we're at, in my humble opinion. Gold's at an all-time high, silver's at an all-time high, the market's at our all-time highs, you know, Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, whatever is all-time high. And I know everybody has opinions on those things, and God bless you, I'm not trying to challenge your opinions on them. But the thinking is, right, oh, yeah, I can spend more. But then it also affects people that are maybe not participating in the market.
There it is.
Right? Maybe, you know, here I just discovered the infinite banking concept and I just started a series or a policy or a series of policies. You know, I understand the concept and I want to apply that. And here they are affected as well. I mean, we're all affected. None of us are, you know, unaffected. And so then it challenges me or the individual, you know, to question themselves and their decision making and their intelligence. You know, I'm doing this and it's going to be a couple of years of startup, which you cannot get around the startup, the capitalization phase of a life insurance policy or any business. You cannot get around.
How about anything?
Yeah.
I mean,
anything.
Pay your dues.
And so here I've just started. It's all-time high. You know, James, why would I buy life insurance just because you're a commissioned salesperson or you're, you know, you got a great personality or you've got a great intimidating presentation. You know, everybody else is doing this and they're all questioning my intelligence when I just buying whole life insurance, right? And I just remember talking with you about how it affects the thinking. You know, we become self-critical that,
yes,
I'm influenced by this business cycle theory, even though I may not be, you know, and most of the time, most of the people, and I don't be too broad here, but when you're euphoric and everybody's doing it and, you know, oh, leverage. When does leverage come into application in the Austrian or business cycle? When does leverage occur, right? Nobody's leveraged. Very few people are leveraging, you know, and everybody's losing money. They're liquidating because they've already leveraged. Okay. So my point is that you have this business cycle. And we're headed or at the peak, there's leverage involved. Everybody's questioning, right? The people that are in the market that are all in, leverage in, maybe they're not leveraged, but they're all in. It's like, why isn't everybody doing this? You're a fool not to be here, right? And so if you're the fool, quote unquote, air quotes, right, that's not there, then it's like more of the noise. It's just another variety of noise. I should be doing that. Everybody, my brother-in-law, whomever, the gurus are questioning my intelligence, mm-hmm, to the point, right, where I start to question myself. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just—
And what you've done and the premiums you're paying and the policies you own.
And what you're not doing, right? So in the conversation, that point in the conversation was just that the 4% rule, the sequence of returns, risk, doesn't just affect the retiree.
No,
quote unquote, or the person that's, you know, right to the red zone, whatever the marketing term, you know, 5 years away from retirement or what have you. And the problem, so I'm just saying the effect is broader than just the individual receiving, yes, income from accumulated assets. And most of the accumulation is in entities, products and items that you cannot control. You can get mad and quit putting money in. I got that's a limited amount of control. You can get mad, start withdrawing, face all the penalties and all the, I mean, so there is a limited, you cannot control the business cycle at all. And then I think the conversation went further that, you know, we're talking about Austrian business cycle, right, theory. And then we all individually as a business, in business, in the home, and we've even talked, maybe that was on your private recording, the root word of economics, right? So in the home, every home has a business cycle. Every business has a business cycle. Now, some may be more correlated to the overall business cycle, which, you know, is manipulated. I don't want to go down any rabbit holes, but it's totally manipulated, or let me, the cause from the Fed, okay?
So many good things there. So, to what you helped me see was that this point about the inducement into sequence risk of the business cycle is really just one example of the effect on financial decision-making of the business cycle. It really, there's a cascading effect that takes place regardless of a particular person's age and their status in life, their position and their profession and so on. And one of those additional examples is this FOMO of everything's just flying off the roof. I need to get involved, right? Which is just such a great point. And there's really a – go ahead.
I've seen it affect clients and people that are not clients that practice infinite banking within their own life, right? It's like, oh my gosh, I'm going to over leverage my policy to take advantage, or I'm going to reduce the premium, have dividends offset the premium, have the policy surrender values to pay a premium, whatever, to then go buy, therefore not miss out on these asset values that are only going to go one way, right? Einbahnstrasse, right? One way. No. And then the financial guru is like, well, Mr. Griggs, of course we're aware of the Austrian business cycle theory. We've heard that. I can say those words. Okay. Listen, of course we include the sequence of returns risk in our plans, you know, and we address that through, you know, diversification and asset allocation. We're keenly aware of that. So, you know, you go buy the life insurance or the annuity for a buffer from the volatility of the returns. I mean, I understand. I'm not negating the idea of the value of addressing the sequence of returns risk. It exists. You should be aware of it. You should address that, right? So I'm not negating that. I'm kind of cracking on the industry.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, it's like we do that through diversification. You know, precious metals non-correlated to the market. You know, cryptocurrency is non-correlated to the market, and we're looking at a really long time horizon. So you can withstand the volatility, right? And it's like, okay, tell me when your 77-year-old client, female, who's taking care of an older, most of the time an older spouse in that situation, you know, who's maybe failing in health. You know, tell me where is she going to go sell her 55,000 or 125,000 or whatever the number is of gold, right? Is she going to drive down to the pawn shop, you know, every month to sell it? You know, is she going to do it all at once? Is she going to dollar cost average, you know, and do it on a monthly basis, right? When is
I have to say this, on the asset allocation, because I've heard that, right? It's like, oh, we just and look, we'll just target date it. Don't leave it to, you know, innocent, imperfect human beings. We've got, you know, magical, special, holy, righteous AI that's going to do the algorithms, and they're going to automatically reallocate across. And so that's just how, you know, through human imperfect knowledge, we'll overcome the very problems that we've created in the system. And it's like, yeah, how did that work? How did the asset allocation magic work when Jerome Powell decided to hike interest rates the greatest rate ever in recorded history? Right. And interest rates and bond values move inversely. So, okay, the logic of the target date fund, where I'm going to reallocate out of stocks and into bonds, and bonds are safe, right? Because, okay, the value of stocks can go up and down, but bonds just, you know, they steadily go up over and over. They didn't go up so steadily when the Fed decided to hike interest rates up. And it's not like that's the first time that's ever happened either. Volcker did it, right? So
him did it.
Going back to things being outside of one's control, and at the way the system is built is these things are at the discretion of major institutions and, of course, politically connected individuals that you cannot sit down and model and put in your magic Excel spreadsheet. Say, oh, this will solve it. The only place one can accumulate capital where the value once built is guaranteed is the whole life insurance world, and annuities being an insurance-based product. It's in life insurance. That's it. That's the only place where there's a counterparty guaranteeing the value on a recurring basis.
I remember when counterparty risk was a big topic in, in Las Vegas at a Austrian type, libertarian type convention. And it was, well, what's the counterparty risk? Oh, there's so much there. I want to touch on the target date. You know, when you go to work and you have retirement benefits, now you have to opt out of the qualified plans, right? Because you're automatically enrolled at the time of employment, and you're automatically enrolled into target date funds. You know, Barry Dyke talks about them in his works, three books, right? Available at Nelson Nash Institute, the Economic Warrior, his website, our website, bankwithlife.com. The target date funds, right? So the younger you are, the further out the target date is. The target date of retirement is what the date is targeting, your retirement, right? So the younger you are, you have more exposure to equities, right? And the closer you get to retirement, let's say I'm 60 and I go to work and I'm automatically enrolled in a shorter target date fund that has a shorter time period for retirement. So I might be 80% bonds and 20% equities. This is not complicated. It is not. It doesn't take much to look behind the curtain and really see what it is, right? It's not overly complicated. Okay. And then and I love your point, you know, totally agree. You know, the life insurance company, they're making the underlying guarantees. And where do they, pray tell, put the capital that you send them in the form of premium? You know, and I've said this many times, say it again. I think, you know, repetition is tolerable in the right application. I pay a premium to the life insurance company. That is no longer my money. That becomes the property of the life insurance company. I have purchased a contract and all of the rights and privileges of that contract, right? And we know it's life insurance. So there's a guaranteed death benefit. Yep, may have a non-guaranteed component because we're with mutual companies. And because we're with a mutual company, we're owners of the company. Therefore, we share in the financial experience of the life insurance company, which they cannot guarantee. Nor can any company other than the government contractor, if they're big enough, can guarantee the profitability in the future. They can't. Likely they're going to be profitable. Can they guarantee how profitable they're going to be in a future year? No. So, therefore, the dividend from a life insurance company that you're a part owner of is not guaranteed. Okay, but, you know, they're a 100-year-old company, 150-year-old companies, 125-year-old companies, and they've never failed to pay a dividend. Okay, I'm pretty confident, very, very confident that they're going to pay a dividend. I'm very confident that the companies that we own and encourage our clients, prospective clients, to consider, very confident that they're going to pay a dividend. Will the dividend go up and down? Yes, it'll go up and down. My point here is, where does the company put that money that is no longer yours when you send it to them in the form of a premium? They put that money to work to meet their future guaranteed obligations, which is your graduation. Oh, wait, and they have a cash value. So there's a guaranteed cash value. So in the future, if I pay this premium, I know I can get mad and quit in year 10, year 5, year 2, year 20, and walk away with a guaranteed value. They have to put that money to work to meet those future guaranteed obligations. I promise you, they are not buying any amount, significant amount of cryptocurrency, right? I know one of the big four bought $300,000 in cryptocurrency a couple of years ago.
It's called a marketing spend.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. And so I know they're not, you know, putting the majority of their investable assets into the stock market or real estate. But do they? Yes, they do put money into the stock market. Very limited basis. Yes, they do put money into real estate. All forms. I get it. And that has its own non-correlated, you know, asset. I get it. Where do they put the majority of that money to meet the future guaranteed obligations? They put it in bonds. Okay. Corporate bonds of varying durations, high grade, mid grade. They don't buy junk bonds. Right, and then government bonds. Okay, and I want to make a point here. My point is that, yes, there is an inverse relationship. Interest rates up, bond values down. Interest rates down, bond values up. You know, I don't have to worry. I don't have to be concerned about a sequence of risk returns because the life insurance company is managing that portfolio over a 120 theoretical life expectancy. All right. So now, and go to Dalbar. Do some research on Dalbar, D-A-L-B-A-R. They're an industry data provider. And see what the returns over any length of time, especially correlated or compare it to the S&P 500 returns and the bond returns. See which one has won since, you know, 1920 or 1930. I'll make my point. They never rarely go back pre-1900, so I'm not just licking the boots of Dalbar. I'm just saying there's data out there. Okay, now, wait a minute. If I want stability and longevity, especially as I age, and I don't have to go sell precious metals, I don't have to manage a big real estate portfolio, I don't have to worry about the business cycle and the interest rate environment, which you cannot control. We all can't. We all know this. I know I'm pointing out the obvious, but here we have a life insurance company that's been managing this portfolio for a long time period, and I get the government comes in with the Dodd-Frank Act, you know, the Dodd-Frankenstein Act, in the industry, you know, it's been reduced to the Frankenstein Act, you know, mark to market. How are you going to value those bonds? Are you going to value them at today's values when interest rates are really high and bond values are down? You know, all of these games that the state plays, it's like, I'm putting my money into life insurance and they're primarily investing in bonds of all durations, government, corporate, I get it. Do I have to worry about interest rates up or down? That I can worry all day long if I want to. I can't control it, so why should I worry about it? It's like, yeah. And so when you said that, it just brings to mind, I don't know how many times I've had conversations with clients, you know, skeptical people, people who don't like life insurance. I get all that. That's what came to my mind is, where does the life insurance company put the money? They put them in bonds. I don't care if interest rates go to zero. Well, I do, but not for the stability of myself and my family and our team. You know, I'm not concerned about that.
And that's the point, is that is the job of the life insurance company, is to manage sequence of returns risk. That is the job. And that, as it turns out, it's not like there's special unicorns. There's a whole industry in the mutual life insurance world that has successfully done it for over 100 years.
Oh my goodness.
So it's not like this is some purely theoretical, imaginary. No, they've been doing it for longer than those tax-qualified plans have existed, right? So there's evidence to support the theory. I'll say this too, because where this off, you start getting into the durability and the resilience from a financial perspective of a mutual life insurance company, and then it's like you could almost hear the switch flip, how quickly we go into what's called the Nirvana fallacy. Right, so there's an article by the economist Harold Demsetz called "Information and Efficiency: Another Viewpoint" in the Journal of Law and Economics. Not too long ago, back in April of 1969, so this has been around for a bit. But the Nirvana fallacy is the comparison to the illegitimate comparison to Nirvana, to the perfect alternative. Wait, Jane, are you telling me that, you know, I don't get absolute perfect predictability in everything, like the future stream of dividends? It's like, yeah, no, you don't, because here we are down here, this side of heaven, where we've got to deal with imperfect human beings and institutions. And so let's not compare the proposal to the perfect, unrealistic alternative. Let's compare what's available to what's available. And the question becomes, do you want to accumulate financial value with an institution whose explicit job and has the historical track record of properly executing on the job of managing successfully sequence of returns risk, or do you want to accumulate a bunch of financial value in something that is directly, obviously exposed to the fluctuations of the business cycle, which, as we've pointed out again and again, none of us can control? That's the question. It's an inescapable question. And so it really becomes a question of, am I going to be tempted? It is temptation in the biblical sense. Am I going to be tempted by the world, by the advertised rates of return, by the financially engineered products of Wall Street? Am I going to be tempted by that?
Yes. Yes. The answer is yes. Yes.
And you've got if there's any proof of free will, you've got the agency to go and explore and experience all that. You know, as one of my clients has recently mentioned, he's like, you know, this is all really great. And, you know, whenever someone starts that, there's the magic words coming,
but,
right?
Yeah. Behold the underlying truth. Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think this is all, you know, the end all be all. I think I should be still investing in, you know, inflation, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, just to bring us back down to the reality here, Nelson Nash never said, and the infinite banking concept was never proposed as the magic one-stop fix all. It was never positioned as this is the only thing you should ever do. Just pay a premium and do nothing else. That was never the proposal. So if that idea has percolated in your mind, just know it doesn't have any basis in how the infinite banking concept was actually presented or what its content consists of. The idea was always to say, this is a matter of better positioning oneself to accumulate capital in a guaranteed environment, in a tax favorable environment, in a private environment, in a non-market correlated environment, in one in which you have guaranteed contractual, private, legally enforceable control over, and that positions you better than storing up financial value, non-guaranteed financial value in something exposed to the business cycle, which none of us can control. That was the point, right? And then Nelson's examples, his characters in Becoming Your Own Banker, are all showing different ways of utilizing capital. Now, they're on durable consumption good purchases, the purchase of a vehicle, CD Sisters. It's showing the purchase of a durable production good, the tractors and trucks in equipment financing. Like, there's different examples.
Education. Yeah.
Yeah. Education. These are all of those are different examples of the use of the system. And then Nelson himself would give his own stories in the seminars and in his second book, Building Your Warehouse of Wealth, where he talks about how if you have access to a large pool of financial value, then opportunity will track you down. He's explicitly emphasizing the entrepreneurial and investment opportunities that come your way as a result of being well capitalized. So one cannot say that it was an original part of the IBC to say that all you should do is pay a premium and do nothing. That was never the deal. That was never, nor was the deal ever to say, this is perfect. We're not fulfilling this isn't nirvana. It's not meant to be. It's to say that this is how one can best position oneself given what's available this side of heaven. And
I love it. I love it. You know, you spit out so many great points that can you know, go a lot deeper. Okay.
It's been a few months. It's piled up.
fair. Okay. The nirvana. You know, I want to say, and I've said it in the past, that, you know, I think when it comes to financials, you know, nirvana is like when you can use, blend, coordinate life insurance with either generational trust, you know, in perpetuity, what do they call it?
Dynastic
trust. Dynastic trust and or foundations, right? They, you're getting pretty close to Nirvana.
Yeah.
And I just want to say that I feel like that I've gotten closer and closer to Nirvana. I'm not saying the infinite banking concept is Nirvana. I'm just saying me personally, I get closer and closer to Nirvana. And then it's interrupted by my own personal actions. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And then I want to back to the 4% rule, which, you know, is where the it was vaguely referenced, I think, in his original work, The Sequence of Returns Risk, yeah. that you, you know, we're going to look at me using where we are going to collaborate. I don't know. I'm kidding. We're going to produce an academic work, and you know who's going to ultimately have the final writing. You know, we're not kidding.
This is news to me, by the way. I've been dripping on him saying, hey, you know, we could co-author some papers and submit them to these journals like the Journal of Financial Planning. Like, this is wide open. So you heard it. As I did.
That's not all he's doing. I'm like, don't come at me, bro. It's like, just put it on the schedule. And then he's like, oh, yeah, your schedule. Yeah, okay. All right. Look, in 2022, at the Banking with Life event, and I know we didn't do one in 2024 or 2025. We did one in 2024. So it's a 2023 Banking with Life event. My presentation, I fully addressed, broadly addressed, right, from at least a 5,000-foot overview, not so high that the optics aren't clear, but going through all of the works or the generations in Nelson's book, because what he referenced, equipment financing, the CD sisters, the cost of an education, all of those different illustrations were across generations, different structures. I incorporated those generations, and I think I went out four generations and added in, you know, the idea of an even distribution of age classes, and just broadly built these illustrations, explain, go through them. I could have done a better job. I walk away from everything I do most of the time. What could I have done better? Self-critical. I get it. But my point is, what I demonstrated, which is entirely possible for the you and me individual, the income was triple compared to the 4% rule, using the 4%. Right? And
yes, I remember this.
And I excluded on purpose, intentionally, didn't include the net death benefit to the next generations. Okay, so I was conservative on many levels, right? Okay. All right, and then I want to say, too, that, you know, when you mentioned Nelson, this is not supposed to be Nirvana. This is not – Nelson didn't say you only do this, nor did he ever demonstrate, encourage, illustrate, talk about having your policies leveraged to the nth degree. Okay? He didn't talk about that either. Then let me say, if you – and you know this if you've read Nelson's books. You already know this. So maybe I'm speaking to the people who haven't read Becoming Your Own Banker or Building Your House of Wealth. Nelson was very active in real estate, extremely active in timber real estate and others, right? So his story's in the book, 1980. Where do you think he put most of his money – capital, cash flows after 1980, and he got all the experience he wanted in real estate and did very well with it until he didn't, along with everybody else. It wasn't him that didn't do well from the decisions he made. It was the business cycle theory and government intervention, right? Like, there's a history of that. There's a history of that. So, no, Nelson didn't say this is the only thing you should do. And he sure didn't say if you do this, you should, you know, leverage your policies to the nth degree. And I know Nelson was also aging, right? The book was published in 2000. He was born in 1931. Okay. So that could have had a bearing on where he put his money. But I know what he bought most of after 1980, and it was life insurance. Although I do got to make a caveat, he speaks about it in Building Your House of Wealth. He did buy some silver at the market high of 40. just because, you know, he did own things where, you know, people couldn't come at him like he was ignorant, you know, or didn't have any experience. So I'm just saying, if he were around, or, you know, maybe he left that silver to his people, he could finally make a profit after 10 years, you know. And then, okay, so I could keep going, and I think I don't want to end. I'm just saying, those are points that I wanted to make. And there was another point too earlier. I think when it comes to target date funds and all of these things are, you know, off the charts, and diversification, is that the only thing you do? Life insurance? No. Does that mean the only thing you should do is precious metals? No. Does that mean the only thing you should do is any one thing? You know, and I'm not a gold bug, but I like precious metals. I'm a numismatic collector, have been for a long time. You know, these coins are wrapped in history. Anyway, but looking at precious metals, you know, I think they've outperformed. I'm not trying to cherry pick any time frames. I know there was a flat, long period, but that they've done pretty well. Precious metals, right? That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, compared to these exotic, you know, portfolio managers.
Yeah. And that's great. I mean, and by the way, counter-cyclical is great, but counter-cyclical is still cyclical.
It's
great for a time, and that's
awesome. Yeah. It depends on what part of cycle you're in, right? Hmm. You know, another thing, when have conversations about life insurance, what do they do with the money? Where do they put the money? You know, because it's not yours when you send it to them, and then bonds come out, and it's like, oh my gosh, what's the counterparty risk on the bonds? And isn't the dollar going to collapse? You know, I mean, that is a 50, 60 year argument about the collapse of the dollar.
It was going to collapse in 72.
Oh, yeah.
And here we are. I mean.
Yeah, April. I think April, they closed the gold window. What does that mean? We haven't been on the gold standard since the 30s, 1933. You know, Uncle Franklin, right? Franklin Delano Roosevelt. You know, the second great wave of socialism to come across our country. You know, when he confiscated. We got off the gold standard at that time. Everybody wants to reference 1971, right? Or a lot of people do. And let's be clear what happened in 1971, right? The foreign countries, namely France, they could return the U.S. dollars that they owned for a $32 ounce of gold in 1971 through what was called the gold window at the Fed. That's what was closed. That's what was stopped. That doesn't mean the dollar was then, well, I guess it could mean we were never tethered to gold then. The U.S. has been off of the gold standard since 1933.
Yeah, we're pushing 100 years. I mean,
yeah. It's like, okay.
And that, which is all great history to be aware of. The fact remains, too, and as I pointed out to this same client, he continues to ask good questions, but the same thing came up. You know, the collapse of the dollar. You know, they sell dividend-paying whole life insurance in Canada, too. And there are companies in Singapore, I know for sure, that sell life insurance. And you can get other forms of life insurance in, like, the UK and Europe. Which is to say that life insurance, there's nothing essential to life insurance that requires the U.S. dollar, right? You can denominate the math in whatever money unit you want, right? And like this is, in fact, it was a former president of the Mises Institute, who I like, so I'm not going to name him in this regard. But
you only name the ones you don't like?
Well, no, I like the guy, so I'm going to criticize him here. But, you know, he's like, owning whole life insurance, that's dollar denominated.
Oh, yeah.
It's like all assets are money denominated. that's, you know, the money right now is the U.S. dollar in the United States and in many parts of the world. And someday that may change. And maybe that day is sooner. Maybe it's later. I don't know. But when that happens, all assets, including dividend-paying whole life insurance, will then be denominated in a different money.
Revalued, right? So Let's say I own a farmland. Let's say I own equipment and I own life insurance and I own stocks, and their denomination changes, the currency changes, right? The revaluation, whatever may occur. All of the assets, every one of those things are going to be
revalued
in that new currency.
Yeah.
It's like, okay. I'm totally okay with that. I can move. If I ever come up missing, I tell my wife all the time, if I come up missing, I'm going to be in Scotland, maybe in France, right? And so if I go over there and I get a loan, and I don't plan on, I'm just saying, if I get a loan and I own U.S. life insurance and they send it to me in my bank over there, and it has to be a U.S. affiliate bank and blah, 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 all that, I jump through all the hoops, right? I'm going to convert those U.S. dollars into the currency, which would be the euro, right, in the U.K. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so not – I mean, it makes for great marketing. You know, it just adds to the FOMO, right? It influences my behavior. And so I therefore believe totally that history is very important. Just to be aware of it, have an idea, because, you know, we all say history repeats itself. If it doesn't, it surely rhymes. You know, when is the federal government? I'm not trying to, you know, bang on the state all the time. But when are they going to all of a sudden, you know, come to the awareness that they should be good? Right, that they should not expand. The idea of not expanding may be a good idea. They don't even have the ability. So it can't happen. Yeah. Right, so what can happen? Oh, what they've done in the past. It'll just be a new chapter and a new book.
But, new iteration.
Yep. There's a lot. Look, you know, see, this young man has an hour and a half, as you know, to prepare driving down here. And I'm like, I roll out of bed, you know, drive over here in 15 minutes. I make a few notes, and then we didn't even hardly get too down on into them, too deep into
them. There's no way. You got to a lot of that.
Yeah. I do like that. I want to bring it up again, the ignore, the idea of ignoring information. It's willful, intentional ignoring information that's available, whether the information's right or wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. Just don't ignore this idea, because for whatever reason, because somebody gets a commission, because it's life insurance, because you don't like life insurance, because the dollar's denominated in the dollar, whatever reason, don't ignore the information. That the idea that you can become your own banker and what that can mean to you.
In all these very specific ways we've discussed, you know, offloading your sequence of returns risk to an institution whose job it is and has been for a long time to properly manage it in relation to mortality costs. I mean, the one little part, the last thing I'll add is, among all of this propaganda about how you need to give up ownership and control over capital to some faceless third party owned and operated by people who probably don't like you and what you stand for, is it's just implicit diminishment of the individual and of the individual's own capabilities, your own, I think, God-given ability to create, to generate, to produce. You know, the individual I mentioned earlier who was all mystified by the alleged rates of return in private placement VUL, you know, he's just so transfixed by all these kind of what to me seem like small rates of return that are supposed to be great, you know. And he would constantly come up with this thing as like, well, you know, risk and return. You can't get I know it's risky, but look at the return. There's a trade-off. Don't you know there's a trade-off? It's very much like how I joke how Wall Street's convinced people that financial analysis just comes down to identifying a bigger number from a smaller number. It's like, Oh wait, I just need to remember that there's a trade-off between risk and return. Oh gosh, I feel corrected.
And there's an illustration that shows a bigger number with the greater risk you take over the longer time period.
Yeah. So I hit him with this. I'm like, that myth that risk and return are inherently inversely related, like that there's a necessary trade-off, that myth is really just how things are for the poorly capitalized.
What?
And, you know, if you're super well capitalized, if you have access to a large pool of financial value, the scope of circumstances that appear opportune to you, the opportunities, they may actually consist of things that virtually nobody else knows about, where the returns are very high, where the risk is very low, where your degree of control is very high. And these things might not sound like investments, you know, because they don't appear on CNBC commercials, for instance. But, you know, in my own world, when I invest in a relationship with a private printer to generate a run of books, for instance, or when I invest in a new website and I pay a developer to make it look nice and functional, you know, these are investments. I'm allocating capital, I am giving up ownership and control over capital to somebody else. So the book printer, the website builder, so that they can go do something on the expectation that I'm going to get something back, a set of books, a new website, and I'm going to go use those things to go generate a return. Like I am invest. Those are investments in the categorical sense. They may not line up and be found in a publicly traded prospectus somewhere, but those are opportunities. Those are investment and entrepreneurial opportunities that are hyper-local, right? Nobody else is going to publish my book. You know, they didn't write it. Nobody else is going to go build my website. It's my website, right? It's a market of one. And I have complete control. I gave the instructions to the book printer. This is how you will print the book. I gave instructions to the web developer. This is how it will look. Here are the specific color codes. Like, it's going to look this way. I have total control. And then the risk return, is there a necessary trade-off? Look, from the outside looking in, you know, from your perspective, from somebody else's perspective, they may say, oh, you know, yeah, maybe that'll result in, you know, increased business or increased commissions. It's like, okay, thank you for that opinion. I was very confident in what the book would do and what a nice looking website would do. I am very confident in what the results will be of these different investments that I'm making. And so I don't accept that. I don't accept this necessary risk return trade-off. I'm choosing not to participate in that. You can if you want. I mean, if people want that, then there's the question, right? Do people want that? And maybe they do, because by the way, that's what everybody else is doing and the wisdom of crowds, you know, if everybody's doing it, it must be right, right? So maybe somebody wants that security blanket of social acceptance. Maybe that's the real trade-off. Right. Maybe it's security blanket of social acceptance to wrap up your inverse relationship between risk and return. Or maybe you can choose not to do all of that and instead embrace your own creative, generative, productive capabilities.
Personally fulfilling.
Yeah. Meaningful. Meaningful activities. And maybe take a little responsibility. As it's been put to me, you know, I have the opportunity to take responsibility if I want it, to go and do certain things. And maybe that's available to me in the financial world too. And if that's the case, maybe having a whole lot, a high quantity of very high quality, meaning under my own contractual control, capital, maybe that would help me. Maybe it would be better for me if in the process of reclaiming that personal responsibility, I had a bunch of financial value that I could bring to bear in my purchasing power to go do stuff so that I wasn't at the whim of individuals, institutions, and processes outside of my control. And maybe in that environment, I don't have to accept this inverse relationship between risk and return. I get it, you know, the you know, secular scientistic age where we want to, you know, perform our little mathematical Excel analysis and, you know, you can chart out how rates of return vary with risk in a certain publicly traded market. I'm not accepting it. The math is the math. I get it. Trust me, I get it. I did pass an econometrics exam as part of a doctoral program in economics, and I really can do the math and have done it, but that's really not what I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about individuals in real life making decisions on the margin and the landscape that the individual faces, right? Not the landscape that's presented on an Excel sheet. I'm talking about that real world over there. And over there, it is a myth that there's an inherent necessary relationship between risk and return. And I just don't accept that. That's always the case for the very well capitalized. So maybe the thing to do, and then I'll shut up, maybe the thing to do is to re-examine one's own thinking, to rethink your thinking, as Nelson called us to do, and just examine whether we've accepted this prefabricated, mass-marketed idea that we are fundamentally helpless, that we need to rely on outside experts because we're faced with this necessary trade-off between risk and return. Maybe that's the idea. I don't know, but it's at least possible.
You know, listen, oh my gosh, I appreciate that. And I'm so thankful that you passed that econometrics.
I literally have a picture of the letter in case anybody would doubt it's real.
So what I heard, within what I heard, properly capitalized, well capitalized, made a difference. Does make a difference. My consistently people are undercapitalized. They haven't fully embraced a method, a systematic method of becoming properly capitalized. Not often have they really thought through what does that mean? What does that look like? And it looks the total opposite, in my humble opinion, of what the financial world, the hole, the box that they're trying to shove the consumer in, you know? So therefore, that is a major problem that we all have and that we can all change.
If you want to.
Yep, if you want to. Okay, well, I really had fun. I'm glad. We should do this more often.
Yeah. Almost like it's a good thing.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening.
Bye, y'all.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.